Hello and welcome to the Female Athlete Podcast for women who want to learn more about their bodies.
With me, Lucy Lomax.
Me, Georgie Brunvels.
And me, Jess Piasecki.
So this is episode 14 of the podcast and will be the final episode in series one. We just wanted to say we've been absolutely overwhelmed with the reaction and support we've received for opening up the conversation and tackling taboo topics within this podcast. So thank you for being with us on the first part of our journey. And we will, of course, be back for series two at the end of the summer, where we'll be looking to continue to open up the conversation and bring on even more inspirational guests, coaches, athletes and experts in their field to talk about the area of the female body and the female athlete. Right, so in this final episode of series one, in a reverse of our last episode on the menopause, we're actually going to go to the opposite end of the scale and are tackling puberty. So if you are a parent or coach of younger athletes, this could be the one for you. We will spend time this episode discussing the challenges for girls going through puberty and the obstacles they may face to sports participation and why we're seeing a high dropout rate in this age group. Also, we'll speak to Mel Benson, head of St George's Middle School for Girls, for a teacher's perspective. And we're speaking to swimmer Mia Slevin and her coach Jamie Main about how it is to be a young athlete and how they've both together handled Mia's training and transition through puberty. But as ever, before we launch straight into that, Georgie and Jess, what have been your talking points for the past week or so?
For me, just something really quite brief, I suppose. This morning I was having my coffee, watching the morning news as the routine has been since the start of lockdown. And the women's in sport was actually featured finally. So I thought that was a step in the right direction. Obviously, it's taken so long, but it was quite nice to have a feature. And I think Judy Murray said a little bit, there's Stacey Copeland and a few others. Oh, Rebecca Adlington was on there as well. And just sort of raising awareness, the fact that women in sport is particularly taken quite a hit during this time. So needs to be looked after going forward, not only for the women in sport in terms of getting it back on the map, but also, you know, return to play, injuries and everything like that should be considered. So finally, we have been acknowledged. So that's great. And also, I'm not sure if everybody will have seen, but on social media today, Serena Williams, obviously one of the greatest female athletes ever. The picture she had with her and her daughter playing tennis was just like absolutely incredible. I think there's a little video at the end, isn't there? And then there's like three pictures of her and her daughter playing tennis, and she's in like the ready position, as it, I used to call it in tennis. And it's just fabulous. And I think that's sort of doing the rounds already.
Cool. Yeah, I saw that as well. I thought it was a purple one.
Yeah, they're both matching outfits as well, aren't they? Yeah, it's super cool.
So I'd say I have two highlights this week, probably. The first one, going down the football route again, but seeing that the Premier League has invested £1 million in helping the restart of the Women's Super League in the UK. So I think that's really, really positive, obviously. And I think that will allow all of the female athletes to be tested properly and correctly, which is obviously super, super important to control the virus and save lives. And then the other thing, I guess is a highlight really from like my working world, is this week Orico launched a partnership with Wasserman. So Wasserman are a sports agency who work with a whole range of different athletes. So it's really exciting to specifically partner with them, focusing on the female athlete. So as part of that, we're working with 9 different athletes. So yeah, that's really cool. I also listened to this podcast that was with Erin Cuthbert and Judy Murray on it, and it's called the Fair Play Podcast. It's a BBC one, and they were just discussing how to increase women's sport exposure moving forwards, and how it shouldn't all be about trying to put women in the sports pages or female athletes in the sports pages. It's also about getting them or getting exposure in places where women are actually going to have a look. Like, obviously, I mean, I do love reading the sports section of the newspapers, but I love all types of sport, but not everyone does. So actually, you need to get women into or female athletes in front of everyone out there to highlight the what they're doing, and just to, you know, create the role models. And also, I think from a sponsorship perspective, they discuss a lot about how female athletes need to create their own kind of image, and they actually need to help create exposure for themselves to then make themselves more appealing for sponsors. So it's definitely worth a listen, I would say.
Okay.
You've got any highlights, Lucy?
I do. I'd say my highlight, something I just spotted on Twitter, was in the world of women's golf. And it was an article written by Ali Bowes, who's author, researcher and lecturer at Nottingham Trent University. And she kind of specialises in the sociology of women's sport, but and women's golf as well. She's done quite a lot of research in. And Ali wrote an article for Women in Golf just saying, you know, do broadcasters have space for women's golf? Because I think she went back and said, like, in 2019, we had the Solheim Cup and how that had 90,000 spectators there and how everything seemed to really be on the up because it was such a dramatic final. And then now with the coronavirus, yesterday at the third Rose Ladies series event, there was an equally kind of dramatic final, but it wasn't on TV. Like, nobody could watch that from their own homes, which is really sad. And it just highlights, you know, how the women's competitions have all started later than the men, which is true in most sports, as we've previously talked about. But yeah, I just think it's something just to note that, you know, broadcasters need to do better and the mainstream media need to do a bit better with giving women's sport this platform that they need and maybe this push that they will need after this whole pandemic is over.
Okay, so for our last one of this series, actually, I can't believe we've come all this way, so thank you to all listeners. We're going to talk about sort of the adolescent and pubescent period of our lives and how the menstrual cycle for females sort of fits within that time period. Now, I think we've covered quite a lot of physiology in general in terms of the menstrual cycle that happens, you know, for the majority of females' lives, and then lastly, we were able to talk about the end stages of life. So now we've sort of come back full circle and we're starting at the beginning again. And this time period is actually really important for young females and young males, but obviously for this podcast, we're speaking about females specifically. And there's a lot of changes that young girls go through, and the education that the female receives sort of during that time period can also influence her own perceptions and connections sort of with her own physiology and menstrual cycle throughout the whole of life. So we feel this is a quite an important topic to touch upon and embrace a little bit. And hopefully you will hear from our guests as well, who will elaborate on their own experiences and their own thoughts around this area in terms of female physiology. So first of all, let's talk about the just basic physiology and the changes that we go through during puberty. So, Georgie, are you able to sort of give us a one-on-one on this sort of topic area and sort of the changes that we might go through and how that differs then throughout the rest of life and into the end stages of life?
Yes, definitely. So when girls are young, so typically under the age of eight, they hormonally have a relatively similar profile to that of the equivalent aged boys. I always say, whenever I'm delivering talks in or on this specifically, that athletically speaking, girls and boys are often really matched. Like, I remember, you know, racing the boys in the playground, or you know, playing football with the boys and actually being able to, you know, match them really. But then suddenly girls and boys hit this time which we call puberty, and typically this starts for girls a little bit younger than boys, so say around the age of eight. Typically now we would say between the ages of 8 and 10, girls start to enter this period where their primary, like, ovarian or female sex hormones, estrogen and progesterone, start to increase. And initially this can just be seen by having slight changes in, like, body shape and just your body in general. So there can be a bit of, like, budding of the nipples, but also the development of pubic hair, for example, and then a slight change in like body shape. So hips might widen a little bit, a bit more tissue around your bum might start developing as well. And typically this happens for around, or this continues for anywhere between 1 and 3 years, and then the period starts. So we call this the onset of the period menarche. So that's when you have your first blood loss effectively. The whole period of puberty typically lasts around 4 years. And often we say that individuals' periods or girls' periods can start anywhere from the ages of 10 to 13. But actually, particularly in the athletic space, there has been some research shown, and it is relatively common to see periods starting a bit later. That being said, if a girl hasn't started her periods, it hasn't had or experienced menarche by age 16, then we would call that primary amenorrhea, and that's definitely something which needs a medical follow-up just to check that there's no underlying problem and try and identify why that might be happening. Through this time though, it's very normal for girls to experience real fluctuations and changes in how they're feeling, and just like for some people, for example, they might have a massive growth spurt upwards, but then they don't fill out quite, or they might fill out a bit more and then have a growth spurt upwards. So it's a real period of adjustment. And because the hormonal increase isn't like linear, so it's not just like one day your hormones are low, the next day your hormones are high. There's very much sort of an up and down process throughout this whole pubertal time. So particularly in the first year of when a girl starts her period, it's really common to have irregular periods, to have symptoms, like bad symptoms, heavier bleeding, just while the body suddenly has to get used to the sudden influx of these hormones. It is unfortunately quite common for a girl to start her period to experience quite bad symptoms or heavy bleeding and to go to the doctor and immediately be put on hormonal contraception as a means to control the period and the symptoms. Now, I'd be really reluctant to go down that route with any individual that I was working with, just because if there was no medical need for it and no need in terms of birth control, then I think it's really important just to let the body kind of normalize to this process and really appreciate from both an athlete, a practitioner, a parent, a school teacher perspective that everyone's pubertal experience is slightly different, but it's something which is really normal. It's a sign of health, and it's really, really important to allow your body to go through this naturally. Jess, I know you've done some research around the medical importance, particularly with regard to bone health around puberty. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So like you just said, on the pill, you know, some of those girls could be young, really, really young, and to be told to take sort of a hormonal replacement, as it were, is quite a daunting prospect when you could be just 14 years old. So I think we do need to provide more evidence in this area, but just steer away from sort of putting a plaster over something that isn't really going to provide a long-term fix, and look for some other options. But in terms of bone health, like during puberty, so puberty is a really, really important time for young boys and girls to accumulate all of the bone health that's going to support you for later on in life. So as we get older, we, as I said last week, we lose bone mass. And particularly for females, this is more prominent because of the loss of estrogen that you have later on in life. Now, during puberty, because of the hormonal changes, but also your bones are still growing, and so your end plates within the bone structure themselves are quite more, not malleable, but they're a lot more adaptable to exercise and impact in particular. So it's really important that we encourage a lot of physical activity, healthy eating, lots of calcium, so the bone health can accrue its sort of maximum bone strength and bone density. Because then at the ages of around roughly 25 for both boys and girls, it's slightly different, but around that age, let's just say, and after that time, you're not really going to accumulate any more bone strength or bone density for later on in, for the rest of your life. That sort of window of opportunity is closed as such, because you've stopped growing. So that pubescent time is the most prominent time in which you're going to accumulate your bone strength to support you later on in life. And I think last week I mentioned, they think it's around, or researchers indicate that it's around 26% of your bone mass is accumulated during puberty. Well, the bone mass that you gain is going to protect you from the bone mass that you'll lose later on in life, which is around 26% of your total bone density. So imagine if you're sitting on the PlayStation all day, you're not really going to get much physical activity. Your bone mass isn't going to be as strong as it can be. Therefore, you're going to be more predisposed for bone loss and bone fractures later on in life. So that's why it's really important to encourage our children and youngsters of the era to be as physically active as possible and eat, you know, good, healthy diets with lots of calcium and things, which can be tricky, but I think it's really important to stress. And I think that's not really well known. You know, we see all these sort of promotions in terms of let's get our children physically active, but actually there's a need for it, really, if we want to protect them later on in life. It's not just the here and now that it's really important for.
And it's such a fine line as well, because obviously the importance of like regular exercise is so, as you've just highlighted, Jess, it really is, you know, you can't emphasize that enough. But then also there is the balance, particularly to your story, Jess, of not overdoing it through that time as well. And I know that particularly in sports, like individual sports, so like maybe track and field or swimming or triathlon or tennis even, it's that because you're competing individually, like there is a real potential to see slight decreases in performance while there is this period of adjustment of body shape and managing hormonal changes, etc. And I think it's really important to like normalize that and actually to help an athlete understand that actually this is natural and it's, you know, positive. And I think reframing this whole stage in one's life is really important.
Georgie, so we're going to hand over to you now and provide a little interview of yourself. So Georgie is willingly going to share with us her own experiences around sort of puberty, adolescence, and the education she received. So first of all, like, you've got quite an interesting story in your own background during this time of your life. But first of all, what was your education around this sort of pubescent topic, adolescent topic like at school? Can you remember? Were you sort of embracing it or not?
So just for everyone out there, I started my period when I was still in my junior school. So I was 11 and a half, I think. And I had received absolutely no education at school ever around this. Like, it was just not spoken about, not discussed, not like, just not a thing. So I was like unbelievably shocked. I have an older sister, and her and my mum would talk about it, but I was just like, oh, that's not going to happen to me for a while. And it just didn't trigger in my head that it would be something I need to think about for a while. I was also swimming a lot. I was playing netball. I was running at school. I was just like, I guess, a very active kid, but I was so shocked to suddenly have this thing to come and effectively say no to me because I was swimming, and how on earth was I going to manage that? And I remember, like, I actually remember my period starts on a Thursday. Don't know how I remember that now. And I was due to go swimming that night because we always used to swim on a Thursday night, and I didn't go. And then the next day I refused to go to school because I was so embarrassed. And I knew for a fact that no one in my year at school had started their period. I went to a really small school, and maybe they had, but I'm almost positive that they hadn't, because there were no sanitary bins, no nothing provided throughout the whole school. And so I refused to go to school the next day. And I remember, like, a group of my friends came round on like the following evening, and I was terrified that they would find out. I was so embarrassed. I just didn't know what to do about it. And I it was like the world had ended, to be honest. Like, it sounds really, really dramatic, but it was honestly just such a kind of just a barrier for me of like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that this has suddenly come and was going to stop me doing what I want to do. Anyway, I think I was just really, really upset for maybe like 48 hours. And then I remember my sister saying to me, like, don't be so ridiculous. Like, it's fine. Like, you know, there's ways around swimming. You can use tampons. And also she told me that actually exercise would really help and would make me feel better. So I then, I guess, after that moment of misery, I didn't really look back, and I kind of had this mantra in my head of like, well, that's not going to hold me back. That's ridiculous. That being said, I do remember, because I used to swim quite a lot, I do remember like I always had this terror and fear of like, I guess someone finding out, particularly in swimming. I think I just kind of cracked on and just tried not to think about it. But it wasn't, I guess, my pubertal journey and journey around periods didn't end quite yet, in terms of terror from my side. So then we went on into the summer. Athletics kit was all white, so we had white shorts and a white AirTex, which I guess is pretty common. Now, obviously, very normal when you start your period. Your periods are very irregular. So a month later, my period didn't come. So I was then just so scared every day that I was going to start my period in my white shorts and everyone would see and everyone would know. And oh my gosh, it would be the worst thing ever if people knew. And again, because there was no like discussion, no education, no nothing, like I would just never, ever, ever tell anyone. Thankfully, I didn't have like an awful white short experience. But again, that's been a real passion of mine, particularly over the last few years, to try and get white shorts like disposed of and banned from women's sport forever, because I think the trauma that it can cause is horrendous. Again, as I said, like I feel like it didn't hold me back from that initial time. So while I was worried about it, I was still just going to crack on and do what I wanted to do because I guess I just love sport. But yeah, that was a real kind of mental barrier. But then I went to my senior school, and actually I remember potentially having one lesson where we discussed it, but other than that, it was just not mentioned. And I can honestly say I don't think I ever admitted to any of my friends that I'd started my period until I was about 14, because to me there was a massive shame factor. And I used to have this little bag that I would put in my school bag, and it would have some sanitary products in it, and I would literally hide it in the depths of my school bag. And to me, like, touching it was like poison. I didn't want to touch it because it was like, so I was just so fearful of that. And I just, because my periods were irregular probably for the first 18 months, I would say, and so I would never quite know when I would need it, and it would just be this constant internal anxiety. I remember being at sleepovers and being terrified that my period would suddenly start, and then oh my gosh, what happens if everyone would find out? It's really crazy how much it can affect you, and I don't even know why, because I had a great group of friends and I don't think they would have judged me for it. In fact, I know that some of them started actually in year 7, so the first year of senior school, and they were sort of 11 or 12, and even then I felt like there was just this shame factor to it. But yeah, it's crazy looking back, and I think that's again been a massive passion of mine, to try and change this, and actually make people be proud of being a woman. And actually, you know, it should be a positive experience really going through puberty. And I also wish, like what I know now, like tracking my own cycle so I'd know when to expect it. Again, another reason why I feel so strongly about tracking periods. And yes, I was irregular initially, but then my cycle was regular. So if I at least knew when to plan, like if I could plan ahead, then I wouldn't feel that I had that internal terror that it was just suddenly going to come and I was totally underprepared.
Yeah, I like what you're saying. I feel for you, Georgie, because that sounds like, I actually myself was a late starter. So I think I started the day after my 15th birthday. So like, we would have had like 4 years, or maybe 3.5 years, where you would have had this experience, you know, and you know, I didn't. But it's so strange to think about the differences in individuals. But just going back to the white shorts point, is from your side of the story, like, you know, young, you know, grassroots sport, and thinking about like the England Lionesses and playing at Wembley in front of a crowd of 80,000 live on telly, and can you imagine wearing white shorts there? And if you're like on the first day of your period, thinking that thought terrifies me beyond, like, I can understand why some internationals might, is it the progesterone only pill where you don't have your period? I'd be completely, you know, paid to potentially go on that, because I'd be so worried about those types of instances. But maybe that's just me. But like, you just do think, like, why are we putting these women in that position?
Yeah, and thinking from a young athlete perspective, that the likelihood of them, I guess, like being even more concerned about it. I mean, yeah, they might not be playing at Wembley, but still, like the fear factor, the embarrassment factor is so, it's so big. And I think if you look at girls dropping out from sport, we know that through the teenage years, girls drop out from sport at twice the rate of boys. 50% of girls who are playing sport pre-puberty have stopped by the age of 17. And you think, how can we prevent that? Well, like, that's, this is definitely not going to help. And we actually know that the effects of puberty generally are actually one of the primary causes. I know that as well, the US women's national team, so the US soccer team's kit includes white shorts as well. So you just think, like, what's going on? And we know the prevalence of heavy menstrual bleeding, up to a third of women are heavy bleeders. So that likelihood is that much more. I also think, Lucy, to your point of you being a late starter, I think it is really hard because there's often the why me thing. And I think, again, for me, I was like, why me? But then my mum and my sister were both very young, and they were both actually 11 and a half too. There's definitely a genetic link in my eyes to your onset of menarche. So I think that's when, you know, you have kids. So for any parents out there, like, just thinking that there's likely to be a degree of genetics in terms of when someone starts. But I also think, For you, Lucy, I remember having one of my friends not start until she was probably a similar age. And I remember she got to that age and she was like, what's wrong with me? Like, why haven't I started? And that almost creates anxiety as well. So it's just such a difficult area or time to navigate. But I really believe the more open discussion, the more it's normalized, the better.
Yeah. And sort of at that stage, you're not ready to talk openly like we might do now with our close friends and things about these intricacies of the female body. You're still at sort of the embarrassment stage, aren't you? Like, but if you, like you say, you change that perspective, then it might feel a bit different.
I think I almost had a negative way of looking at it because I blanked it out. I pretended it wasn't there, hence why I was always willing to not have to use that bag in my bag. It was crazy. But I also think now, if I was to speak to my former self, or if I was to educate myself now, I would try and step back, and this is what I'm always saying, like, it's not just about the bleed, like, it's a whole cyclical process, and seeing it more objectively, I think, would have helped me massively.
Yeah, and just like, I'm going to speak to a young athlete and her coach later in this episode, but you think about how it could affect, you know, younger elite athletes on the highest, you know, sporting stage of all. So it's a really worthwhile question, and I think that links to just the fact that I feel that girls have the odds stacked against them so much, because not only do you have this whole like menstrual cycle thing to like navigate and discover and find out about, but you've also got your breast development, your boobs. You know, your boobs are another massive factor that stop women, young girls from playing sport or dropping out. And the fact that you've got the body image thing, you know, society thinks women should look, or girls should look a certain way. And so it's like, boys don't have any of that. So it's just like, yeah, I think it's really important. Well, what do you think needs to change, Georgie? How would you like to see this being tackled, like from primary school level upwards, like now and in the future?
Yeah, I that's a really good question and a really good point as well. Like, I think breast development, but also things like suddenly you start sweating more and understanding more about personal hygiene. I think that really needs to be discussed as well. But I think obviously if we know that puberty can start at around the age of 8, like education really, really way, way back. And for both girls and boys together, I would say, even though it's like people could think it's embarrassing, but if girls are educated about girls' puberty and boys' puberty, boys are educated about girls and boys, I think that helps to normalize it. But I think we need to stop the focus on almost like the period. It should be about the whole menstrual cycle, and the period is one part of it. But I also think we need to have more role models out there, like sharing their experiences through puberty, but being really objective with it, of not like, oh, I had such bad cramps, or, oh, I didn't perform well on day one or whatever. It needs to be really positive about how people navigate it. But saying that, I think there also needs to be, it's all well and good being educated at age 8 and then, I mean, I would have forgotten it the next day probably when something else comes along. So I think there needs to be this kind of undercurrent of regular communication, like regular, I just think the normalization of the whole thing needs to be introduced at a much younger age. I would also love to see young girls like starting to be encouraged to track their cycle and their feelings and just to understand a bit more about their own body, to see that everyone's journey is a little bit different. But then also to your point, Lucy, of keeping them in sport, really.
So time for our first guest. We thought it would be wise to get a teacher's perspective on these issues.
So today we are delighted to be joined by Mel Benson, who is currently the head of the middle school at St George's School for Girls, and have been there for about 11 years. Mel's real passion is around sport, with a particular focus on tennis. Mel is also an ambassador for She Rallies, the Judy Murray Foundation and Miss Hit.
So Mel, it would be interesting to know, how do you approach the topic of puberty, periods, sex education, all that types of thing within your school?
Well, what we do is we get to know the girls as best we can, and we get to know what we think we can deliver well, and we try and create the best sort of safest environment around them to make them feel comfortable and confident. So our curriculum is designed that way, and on our campus we're still teaching, like I said, primary education, and then we start secondary education. So because we're an all through school, we can make sure that year group or group within the year groups, the different class sizes, get exactly what they need. And if for some reason they don't get what they need at that age, we're teams, our communication is key throughout this transition. We might filter something that we didn't think was appropriate to cover in primary education because of that group of girls for whatever reason, and we will shift it to the next year and make sure that they get the knowledge, skill set they need, the content that they need, so that they feel comfortable and confident growing up and they can take on the different challenges that they need to take on. But we do it where it's really appropriate for them. So recently, obviously, we've been through lockdown and we've been delivering education on the screens, which has certainly been different for us. So we've actually made some changes. So, for example, if you take the typical primary six sex education topic, not all of that was actually appropriate to be delivering on the screen. And we've decided what was appropriate to deliver. We wrote to the parents and ensured that their daughters could get the privacy they needed. We said when we were going to deliver this, what we were going to deliver, so that they could support them if they had any questions. But we asked for those girls to be learning these lessons in private so that they don't feel embarrassed. Normally in school, obviously, we can control the environment and we can make them feel safe. And we can put certain staff in the room where they have a really good relationship with. But we couldn't do that over the screen. And we're very much aware we don't know who else is in the room. So we needed to try and create that environment as much as we could, so that they could, it's still going to be, a teaching and learning experience. They were still going to engage in the lesson and they're going to get the knowledge that they needed and that we felt we were confident with delivering on the screen where appropriate. And we have shifted some of that model into next year in the health ed block where we didn't deliver. So for example, we did deliver on periods. We felt we could do that. We've touched on it a wee bit in school. We felt that the girls know the knowledge that they had before we into that we could develop that, but we didn't start brand new topics. We felt it wasn't the right environment to do that for them, and where we can't control the environment as much as possible, we felt it would be better to wait on return to school for that. But we need to let kids try and manage things themselves and try and work it out and try and get through themselves. If they know that we're there at arm's length for a bit of support and an ear, and they can call on us when they need this, but if they can go through that process themselves to work it out, then that's the best support, that, in my opinion, that we can give them, whether we're the teacher, the parent, whoever it is, because, well, from where I am at my school, the age and stage they're at, in 7 or 8 years' time, they're leaving home. And that is it. They need to go and face the challenges that they're going to face in the big bad world. So if we hold their hand through absolutely everything and show them every way, then they're not going to have the skill set for when they leave school and go into, you know, the kind of wider world, like I said. So it's really important that we, as adults, whether our role as a teacher, the parent, whoever, is we create that sense of trying to work out yourself, trying to get through that challenge, if it's physically, emotionally, mentally, whatever it is, knowing that there's a bit of support there, but I wouldn't rush it. You don't need to get the end result within a day or two. Get to know the person and get that relationship there, and then watch them and hold their hand through it, and then be very proud of them at the end. Confidence is something that sticks out to me in the environments that I work in. The biggest thing that I'll notice, whether it's with the Judy Murray Foundation and working with women and girls, so younger girls, or working with girls at school, all in a sporting environment, is definitely confidence. Around that kind of age and stage where they may be starting their period, we deliver sport-wise, you know, a new sport every 8 weeks. And that can put them in a new environment, or a new kind of, not uniform or outfit, but it might be a new piece of sporting clothing that they probably prefer to wear for that. For example, going from gymnastics to the swimming pool to the hockey, you're going from skirt to shorts to, what you know, whatever it is, leggings and things. And if they have not got confidence in that situation because they've maybe started their period and they're a bit unsure about it, and they don't know how it can, you know, what the result is going to be through being active and pushing their body into some sort of physical environment, then yeah, it's absolutely, you can tell straight away. In fact, the girls just duck out. You need to really give them the confidence and the knowledge that they require to have, you know, the ability to give things a try and to see, all right, this is fine, I'm okay, I can manage this. It's amazing what being part of a team can do to them, and it gives them that stability through this time. I think sport is so powerful like that. So if you can get those kind of consistent factors there, for example, the hockey team, and they're out training every week and they're playing every Saturday, if they don't follow that routine with their friends, then you know something is really out of sort. But that routine kind of, it does keep them in routine, and because all their friends are doing it, there is more of that pressure to just try and do things as normal, even if they're not feeling great. So I think, you know, if you are sporting, you do take on these sporting opportunities, it really helps with this stage in transition.
Okay, second guests at the ready. Let's get a perspective from a young swimmer and her coach who are aiming for the Olympics next year.
So today we are really excited to have Jamie Main with us, who is the head coach of the Deventio XL swimming team. He is also part of the England Performance Programme and has been working with British teams over the last 12 years. And then alongside him, Mia Slevin. Mia is 17 and she has represented GB at a junior level and has amazing aspirations in the future. So it's really exciting to have both of you on with us today.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for inviting us on.
Firstly, Mia, a lot of what we've talked about today is just around education for young athletes around different aspects of puberty, and I guess with a specific focus on the menstrual cycle. Now, from your perspective, since you have been through a period of time much more recently than us, what were your experiences around school and the education you received at school?
I remember being taught stuff about it when I was in year six. I remember like girls were taken into like a separate room, and we were sort of like told, I can't really remember it like that age, because I hadn't like started or done anything. I didn't have a clue like what it was. I just sort of came out of that lesson like, that's not like nothing to do with me, like and it sort of like just went like brushed past me a little bit. But then I came on when I started when I was 12, and I'm pretty sure I started to learn stuff about it in like biology, in secondary school. Like I think at, like now they're definitely teaching girls at a younger age, because obviously it can happen differently for everybody. So But I just remember, I remember the lesson, but I don't remember what was actually like taught, or I don't think any of it actually like went in.
So then I guess skip forward to when you were 12 and you started your period, like obviously swim, like I presume you were swimming a huge amount at that time, so, and clearly it hasn't held you back because you've got to where you are now. But then how, I guess, did you like navigate that in terms of speaking? I don't know if Jamie was your coach then, but was that something which you discussed with your coach or Jamie, whoever it was?
No, like Jamie was my coach, but we weren't like as close. I think he'd just arrived at my club. Like I started at my first, like it was the day before my first ever nationals. And so that was quite scary. And at nationals, so like you can't really be with your parents, like, cause they're like completely separate. And I remember coming out and like seeing my mum, and I didn't really know what was happening. And like Jamie didn't know either at the time. Cause I was always quite shy, but obviously now I've known Jamie for like more years now, so we're quite open about that, those type of discussions.
So Jamie, from your perspective, I guess like you've been working with swimmers for years and years and years, has it been something that you've always kind of discussed with your athletes, or has it more recently come apparent to you that it's something which needs to be brought up?
We always tried to discuss. I think now we're trying to open the conversation a lot younger, and definitely a big driver in our program has been Mia. So her being a lot more open as she's come through the program has encouraged younger athletes to do the same, and she does a great job of taking the younger ones under her wing and advising them and being that sort of mentor, if you like, to the younger athletes, and trying to sort of break down those barriers of communication. It's one thing that she always felt like when she was coming through, that the senior swimmers weren't as good as sort of showing the right way of doing things, and it's certainly something as she's come through that she's very aware that she wants to inspire and give pointers and make sure that she's someone that is approachable to the younger ones. And as I say, I've always been quite open. I'm the eldest in my family. I've got a younger sister and a single parent family. And I guess I'm quite open around sort of my first experience of a younger sibling. When she started her period, my mum wasn't there, so I had to walk her to the local chemist and I sort of, we mumbled through it ourselves and bought what she needed to buy, and that was quite an eye-opener for a 15-year-old lad. So I'm always keen to try and help and advise and keep the conversation as open as I can.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear. Both Mia, like, I just think that's so impressive for someone of your age to do that. And I think that also that, like, in terms of inspiring the next generation, I feel that there needs to be role models who totally normalize the area, because it's made into this taboo when actually, like, it is a normal, natural process. And I feel, Jamie, it sounds like you take it and you manage it very objectively, like it's a part of being a female and it's a sign of health. So actually, like treating it as that, as opposed to seeing it as menstrual blood loss, which is sometimes more awkward to discuss, but actually the menstrual cycle as a whole is, you know, it is normal, and looking at it more like that, I think makes loads and loads of sense. And it sounds like that's exactly what you're doing.
We try. It's we obviously involve the parents as well when they are young, and just to sort of try and get their support and backing and trust with the things we're trying to educate them around, and obviously the impacts that has on their daily training environment, as well as sort of their energy levels when they're at school and all those areas. So it's a gradual process of trust building, and then education going hand in hand. there's a couple of ways that we do it, and I use those as an example. So we obviously have we set up sort of talks where using me as sort of a role model, where we talk around being open and just trying to show that even though, you know, we are male, some of us are male staff, that we are approachable around these things, and just sharing our own experiences in those talks. But even when we have our one-to-ones with us athletes, off the back of those, we just come at it from an empathetic angle and a caring angle, and try and normalize the conversation for them as much as possible.
Mia, have you found there's any like ways around managing different feelings that you might be having? Because I very much believe that, you know, we need to break down barriers of discussion, but we also need to stop this being a limitation, and we need to work out how we can be really proactive to help with the management of different symptoms, for example.
Yeah. I'd say when I'm like quite moody, or I can be really, really happy, I think just being around people really helps, because I sort of like drive myself away from others. And so like Jamie's really good at helping me just like get back involved. Because obviously there's not many people in my squad, but everyone is really close. And so even if they don't know what's happened, like the boys, if they don't know what's happening, they'll still like talk and like bring you back up to where you need to be. But then if I have stomach cramps, I feel like doing exercise just helps it. Like I've never had to get out of a session or anything for it. I think even if I have got stomach cramp before training, like as soon as I've done like the warm up, I'll be fine. But just being proactive, so knowing that it might happen, helps me get through training.
And out of interest, say next year, hopefully, all my fingers and toes crossed, say you made the Olympics, if you were racing on that like worst day in your cycle, would that be something that you'd be anxious about, or do you feel like now you've kind of navigated it to know how to manage it?
Well, at British Champs last year, I was like, that week of British Champs, that was like my worst week, and I actually performed as well as I could have done, and I made the team, and it was so, that I think that's definitely given me confidence now that it doesn't matter what phase I'm in, like I can still perform how I want as long as I do what I need to do to make sure my symptoms are fine, my mood swings are like, make sure that everything's in place. So yeah, I think that's just given me confidence now to know that I can, like, it's fine and I can get through any week really.
If I could jump through the camera right now and give you a high five.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, like, obviously Mia says, like, last British champs, but I think since Christmas, we've noticed that she's become more and more proactive around a cycle. I think just learning it over time. Because obviously when you're at British Champs, you are fully rested and you're almost, your mood's there because you want to race well. But the daily training grind, I think since Christmas, she's definitely learned to be a lot more proactive around managing symptoms. And we've hardly had to change a thing. Even on that sort of 5 to 7 days, I think less and less we've had to adapt sessions, just through her learning more and more around her body and me learning more and more in when it's going to come and me getting a bit more proactive with the planning, I guess. It's almost given us that intuitive feel to it in a way, which has been really useful. But yes, I'd back that up. I think Mia's at the point now where she could perform on any given day.
So excited, Mia, to see what the future holds for you.
Thank you.
And amazing, Jamie, as well. Honestly, it sounds like you're doing such a brilliant job. And I'm sure loads of coaches out there will be truly inspired by how you're managing all of this. So we had a question in overnight, actually, from a woman who has not had a period, actually, for 4.5 years. She typically plays sport three nights a week and does an hour of gym on top of this. She said that in this last 4.5 years, she has been to the doctor, and the doctor told her that it's because of her fitness that her period hasn't been occurring. And he said that he's not concerned at all. She asked if there's anything that could be causing this and whether there's anything that she should be doing about it. So my first thing is, this is definitely not normal, and not having a period for 4.5 years is not healthy if you're not using hormonal contraception. First thing I would say is having a medical screen to check for any underlying like gynecological problem that could be going on that could be driving this secondary amenorrhea, which is what we would call it. The other things I would say, obviously, as we've discussed before, I think looking at the big picture, so there are obviously a number of reasons why amenorrhea can occur. So there can be a lack of periods, and that can range from not eating enough, not eating enough of the right thing, not eating regularly enough, also doing excessive exercise, so doing too much exercise for the body to effectively deal with, being subject to high levels of psychological stress or other forms of like mental anxiety, also long periods of travel, and not sleeping well enough, all of which can, I guess, independently and combined increase levels of like internal stress hormones, so cortisol, for example, which can partly disrupt the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, so effectively shut down the body's ability to release enough hormones, so primarily gonadotropin releasing hormone, which then causes the release of luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone, which then trigger the or kind of control the release of the ovarian hormones, estrogen and progesterone. So if that whole process is been suppressed effectively by not having enough energy available, too much stress in the total body system, then the menstrual cycle can, or you can actually lose your period and stop having that release of an egg, so ovulation, and lose your period completely. That is not an ideal state in terms of both current body health and long-term body health, and it's associated with a couple of other terms like relative energy deficiency in sport and the female athlete triad, and both of which are not desirable for a long-term kind of health and achieving of optimal athletic performance.
So that's it for series one. We do now have a back catalogue of episodes you can listen to, from the basics of the menstrual cycle to menstrual cycle tracking, contraception and oral contraceptive pill use, iron and the female athlete, breast health, menstrual dysfunction, including endometriosis, and lots more. As ever, if you do have a question around the female body or any queries or questions about any of the topics we've discussed in series one, please do get in touch with us at femaleathletepodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word, femaleathletepodcast@gmail.com, or through any of our social media channels, and we'll be sure to get back in touch with you. Also, if there are any suggestions for topics you'd like us to tackle in series two, please do send those through, as we'd love to hear from you. We'd like to thank the Physiological Society for their funding and enabling this podcast to go ahead. But most of all, we'd like to thank you, our listener. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.